Samuel Adams, a man whom Plutarch, if he had only lived late enough, would have delighted to include in his gallery of worthies, a man who, in the history of the American Revolution, is second only to Washington, Samuel Adams. John Fiske. The fugitives paused on the crest of a ridge just beyond Granny's Hill and looked back toward the town. In the east, the day was just breaking, for the dawn comes early about Lexington in April. Through the scant spring foliage, they could catch glimpses of the vanishing forms of Sergeant Monroe and his guard of 8 Minutemen from Captain Parker's Lexington Company, for this escort had left the fugitives on the Woburn Road and had at once hurried back to join their comrades on the common. Only a little while the watchers waited, and then there came to their ears from the village green the indistinguishable command which all the world has heard now, better than did those listening fugitives on the distant hill. "Disperse, ye rebels, ye cowards, lay down your arms and disperse." Then followed other indistinguishable shouts, the fatal pistol shot, never yet explained, the rattle of arms, and the historic, unanswered volley that made up the Battle of Lexington. And as these sounds climaxed in the volley of British guns, one of the fugitives on the hill turned on the other and made what is set down as one of the few exultant outbursts of his life. "What a glorious morning is this for America," he exclaimed, for he knew that the result he had long foreseen had come at last, and in what he considered the right way. The British soldiers had fired first. The blame and the responsibility were theirs. Conciliation was impossible. The conflict had begun. England was in the wrong. For a brief space they stood, listening intently. Then, not knowing what orders concerning them the vindictive Gage had given his redcoats, the two fugitives hurried on to Burlington, and thence to Billerica, where they made a substantial dinner off cold salt pork and boiled potatoes served in a wooden tray. Then they were up and off again, and so at last they made their risky way to Philadelphia and the Continental Congress. For those two fugitives on the Lexington Hill on that 19th day of April in the year 1775 were two historic Americans, Samuel Adams, the patriot, and John Hancock, whose bold signature we know so well as it heads the signers of the Declaration of Independence. And it was Samuel Adams who made the enthusiastic remark, as upon his ears fell the crack of the British guns at Lexington. He had long been preparing for that important event. Away back in his college days, he had felt it coming, for at Harvard he had made resistance to tyrants the theme of his commencement oration. Is it lawful to resist the supreme magistrate if the Commonwealth cannot otherwise be protected? And the young A.M. distinctly announced that it was not only lawful, but imperative. From that day forward, the right of Americans to resistance and to liberty had been his chief thought, even when others repudiated the idea of independence and reiterated their loyalty to the king. But Samuel Adams educated the people to resistance. To the neglect of his business and his personal comfort and desires, he took up the grand idea of personal liberty and direct representation and drew his fellow countrymen away from old to new truths. Samuel Adams was Boston-born and bred, reared in his father's fine old house on Purchase Street in that sturdy, democratic old town. He was instructed in its schools, developed amid its influences, and early called to share in its affairs as a sober-minded, well-balanced, public-spirited young man. He was an associate of James Otis in all plans that touched the public welfare, distancing even that ardent and impulsive patriot in his opposition to British measures and methods. He made the life of the royal governor Bernard a burden, and finally forced him from his post. He waged a never-ending feud with Hutchinson, chief justice and later governor. He fought with vigor the kingly attempts to fasten a state church upon Puritan New England. He succeeded to the leadership of the Patriot Party when Otis had been beaten into insanity. He denounced unsparingly and unceasingly the quartering of British troops in Boston, and after the Boston Massacre, actually succeeded in having the obnoxious regiments removed from the rebellious town. He led and strengthened public opinion through the colony by his advice to the towns and his practical use of the great power of the town meetings, those assemblies in which New England people freely spoke their minds. He organized the opposition of the people against the hated Stamp Act and advised the action that led to the famous Boston Tea Party. By letters and speeches, by conferences and council, he drew his countrymen into a union for mutual protection against the encroachment of the British crown. He helped form the committee of correspondence by which the different colonies came into touch and accord with each other on the subject of concerted action. He advocated the Congress of the Colonies, which James Otis had first proposed, and he labored to bring it about. He went as a delegate to the First Continental Congress at Philadelphia, and there took a stand as the uncompromising opponent of all concessions to the British crown and as the open advocate of independence. He recommended and took part in the Provincial Congress of Massachusetts at Concord, and when in the Continental Congress fears were expressed lest the bold stand of the colony should lead to an open rupture with England, it was Samuel Adams who bravely declared, "I should advise persisting in our struggle for liberty, though it were revealed from heaven that 999 were to perish, and only 1 of 1,000 to survive and retain his liberty. One such free man," he said, "must possess more virtue and enjoy more happiness than 1,000 slaves. Let him propagate his like and transmit to them what he has so nobly preserved." So bold and outspoken an enemy to kingly authority could not but be a marked man, and it is no wonder that the British government wished to silence him, or that Gage, the British commander in Boston, sought to arrest and imprison Samuel Adams as a rebel to the king. That watchful patriot was wary, however, and the general was slow to act. But when Adams saw that more soldiers were coming from England, he warned the people to be ready for them and to oppose, if need be, an expedition of troops out of Boston to search for concealed arms or warlike supplies. It was this warning that led to the active preparations of the New England militia, and especially of the Minutemen of Massachusetts. It was this, therefore, that induced the rallying of the Minutemen when Paul Revere and his compatriot, William Dawes, galloped out from Boston to warn the country towns of the coming of the regulars, and it was because of this that we may claim, for Samuel Adams, the credit and responsibility for the now immortal Battle of Lexington. When that clash came, Samuel Adams saw that his determined and persistent efforts had at last borne fruit. He felt that resistance to tyranny had indeed taken form, and that the spirit of the people was aroused for a stand for right, for justice, and for liberty. Do you wonder, then, that, as he and John Hancock, arch rebels both and fugitives from British oppression and persecution, stood on Granny Hill in Lexington on the 19th of April, 1775, and heard from the common the sounds of resistance and conflict, he should have exclaimed thankfully and with enthusiasm not often displayed by one so sober and self-contained, "What a glorious morning is this for America!" In that open act of popular resistance, Samuel Adams, patriot and lover of liberty, recognized the dawning of a new day for America, the sunrise of independence. When the tidings of that bloody day at Lexington and Concord, and the tidings of the 20-mile harrying of the Redcoats by the aroused farmers of Middlesex, were speeding through the colonies, arousing them to action, Samuel Adams was posting south to Philadelphia to join his associates in the Second Continental Congress. That Congress was still slow to act, and while they hesitated and temporized, considering new and useless appeals to King and Parliament, Samuel Adams stood almost alone as the champion of absolute independence. Gradually, however, men came to his opinion. One after another, they joined him in his firm and uncompromising stand. And at last, on the 4th of July, 1776, Samuel Adams saw the fulfillment of his hopes and the fruitage of his high desires in the passage and signing of the Declaration of Independence. For Samuel Adams, so one writer declares, that was the most triumphant moment of his life. Even his enemies admitted his great power in this leadership of the forces of revolt. One of them said of him at that time, "Samuel Adams is the Cromwell of New England. To his intriguing arts, the Declaration of Independence is in great measure to be attributed, and Governor Hutchinson, then a fugitive in London, assured King George that Samuel Adams was the arch-rebel of the colonies, for the reason that he was the first that publicly asserted the independency of the colonies upon the kingdom. As for Samuel Adams' fellow countrymen, we are told how they regarded him in those years of his crowning triumph. John Adams of Massachusetts, his kinsman and associate in Congress, declared that Sam Adams was born and tempered a wedge of steel to split the knot of lignum vitae that tied America to England. Josiah Quincy, an ardent patriot seeking health in England, wrote, "I find many here who consider Samuel Adams the first politician in the world. I have found more reason every day to convince me that he has been right when others opposed him wrong." And Thomas Jefferson said, "If there was any Palinurus, that is, pilot, to the Revolution, Samuel Adams was the man. Indeed, in the Eastern States, for a year or two after it began, he was truly the man of the Revolution." And of his influence in the Continental Congress, Jefferson said, "Samuel Adams was so rigorously logical, so clear in his views, abundant in good sense, and master always of his subject, that he commanded the most profound attention whenever he rose in an assembly by which the froth of declamation was heard with the most sovereign contempt." How far he was the man of the Revolution in New England, as Jefferson declared, you have seen in this brief summary of his fearless actions in behalf of independence, and his education of the people of the Massachusetts towns in lessons of liberty. But with the signing of the Declaration of Independence, his great life work practically came to an end. Had he died then, one of his biographers admits, his fame would have been as great as it is now. What further he accomplished, though often of value, an ordinary man might have performed. He seems to have been raised up to show the people the only clear path to independence. After that, the leadership was taken by others. Historians tell us that Samuel Adams was what they term the architect of ruin, that is, he carefully and persistently planned the overthrow of kingly authority in America. That was his mission. He was fitted neither to plan nor organize the successful republic. You can see from the glimpses I have given you of the man and his career that his work was destructive rather than preservative. He was, as you have seen, a rebel against the British throne from boyhood, and this in spite of the fact that both he and his father were, at one time in their lives, tax collectors for the crown. You have seen that almost from his first notable oration at college was a plea for resistance to tyranny, and that his entrance into public life was as the declared opponent of the kingly prerogative. He was the leader and chosen representative of the restless and aggressive people, the tribune of the yeomanry, as someone called him. He advocated and organized rebellion. He urged on the farmers of Middlesex to stand their ground at Lexington and Concord, and when they had fired the shot heard round the world, as Emerson puts it, none was more jubilant, none more enthusiastic than Samuel Adams. This was all destructive work, you see, the overthrow of constituted authority in America. When it came to upbuilding, the new nation looked to other hands than those of Samuel Adams. Throughout the Revolution, he served in the Congress, but his position was rather that of a critic than a leader, and when the government began to take definite shape and the plan of departments that was finally adopted as most practical was proposed, Samuel Adams strongly opposed it. He objected to the establishment of a State Department, of a War Department, and of a Treasury Department, the leading executive branches of our government, and the chief presidential helpers. Instead, he advocated the outgrown and cumbersome conduct of those important departments by committees of Congress, as had been the method during the Revolution. It would have been a great mistake had his plan been carried out, but even in this opposition, he was the same Samuel Adams, fearful of the concentration of authority in the president, fearful lest that office become a one-man power of tyranny, and desirous of having all government and all direction come from the people, through committees selected from them, the people, whose servant and leader, whose advocate and mouthpiece he had been so long. He disliked to exchange the old Articles of Confederation of 1781, which he had helped draw up for the Constitution of 1789, under which we live today. The Constitution would centralize things, he feared. The independence of the separate and sovereign states would be given up. And so, not liking the new order of things, he went home to Massachusetts. There he worked in his beloved town meetings, the people's tribunals, to help the Commonwealth of Massachusetts prepare and adopt a state constitution. There he served the Commonwealth as lieutenant governor and governor, and there he outlived the century which he had helped to make both notable and historic, dying at last on the 2nd of October in the year 1803, in his house on Winter Street in his beloved hometown of Boston, so beloved by him and so much a part of his very existence that one of his associates and fellow workers declared, in just a bit of good-natured complaining, "Samuel Adams would have the state of Massachusetts govern the Union, the town of Boston govern Massachusetts, and Samuel Adams govern the town of Boston. Then, he believes, the whole would not be ill-governed." Samuel Adams, you see, was a patriot for his own times and generation. The Samuel Adams of the America of 1775 would be out of place, lost, and confounded in the America of 1900. How much his state and town revered this stout old patriot, let me show you. There had been an election in Massachusetts, the hotly contested state election of 1800. The political opponent of the old ex-governor had been elected, and he himself was rather despairing of the Republic. Inauguration Day came, and up Winter Street in Boston town marched the great procession escorting the governor to the State House on the hill. There were bands of music, flags and banners, parading troops and political clubs, all jubilant over their victory and filling the narrow Boston street with noise and show and color. As they passed the modest house on the corner of what is today Winter Street and Winter Place, and where in recent years a tablet has been erected in honor of the father of the Revolution, who once lived on that corner, the old patriot, then nearly 80 years old, was observed by the new governor watching the parade from his window. "Halt!" commanded the governor-elect, and procession and music alike came to a stop. Then, stepping from his carriage, while the troops presented arms and the people waited uncovered, the new governor, political rival and opponent, though he was, stood with bared head and extended hands before the door of Samuel Adams, and in a few brief but tender words did graceful honor to his political opponent, the patriot and leader of the people, whose efforts had freed the colonies and given liberty and independence to the land. For the times comes the man. Revolution was inevitable, and God raised up Samuel Adams to be its organizer and earliest leader. Beneath the bronze statue of this historic American, where it stands amid the rush and bustle of what is now called Adams Square in the city of Boston, you may read this estimate of the man: "A statesman incorruptible and fearless." And that is strictly true. As rugged and immovable as the great boulder that, as the century closes, has been placed above his resting place in the old granary burying ground in Boston town, Samuel Adams was at once grand and noble, a fearless, sincere, unyielding, and incorruptible patriot, a true American. And free America owes much to Samuel Adams. He proposed the Revolution. He advocated the Continental Congress. He signed the Declaration of Independence, and was so sharp a thorn in the side of the British government and of the British generals that they tried first to bribe and then to kill him. But they could neither bribe nor kill him. He lived to see the redcoats of King George driven from Boston and, in time, from America. He lived to hail the final triumph of the principles for which he labored and suffered, and to see the people whose welfare he held above all selfish considerations of gain or position, free and independent Americans, beginners and designers of a nation whose greatness even he could not comprehend or prophesy. While Patrick Henry was leading the people of Virginia in their defiance of the Stamp Act, exciting events were taking place in Massachusetts under another colonial leader. This was Samuel Adams. Even before Virginia took any action, he had introduced in the Massachusetts Assembly resolutions opposing the Stamp Act, and they were passed. This man, who did more than anyone else to arouse the love of liberty in his colony, was born in Boston in 1722. His boyhood was quite different from that of Patrick Henry. He liked to go to school and to learn from books, and he cared little for outdoor life or sport of any kind. As he grew up, his father wished him to become a clergyman, but Samuel preferred to study law. His mother opposing this, however, he entered upon business life. This perhaps was a mistake, for he did not take to business, and, like Patrick Henry, he soon failed, even losing most of the property his father had left him.